Okay, I'm so happy to welcome my very first interview. My very first interviewee is my good friend Peter Thorson. He's a countertenor and he's on the faculty at Pace University where he teaches musical theater. And he has such a fantastic background that I actually had to look this up and try and make sure that I'm not doing any of this stuff wrong. So you correct me, Peter, if I've gotten any of this stuff wrong. So besides the teaching that you do at Pace University, you also teach privately and through two programs, Musical Theater College Auditions and Broadway Kids Auditions. And your students have appeared in national tours and productions both on and off Broadway, including Les Mis, Matilda, Something Rotten, Wicked, and Kinky Boots, to name a few. Other stuff I want to say is that you're doing things internationally, and you'll have to tell me if you are actually a spy, because what I found out is that you've taught and have now done some conducting overseas in Turkmenistan and Indonesia, and this is through a U.S. State Department sponsored program called American Voices. So we definitely want to hear about all of that. You recently picked up an award as an independent music teacher from the National Association of Teachers of Singing. And in terms of your own performances, what I got to see most recently in a couple past seasons were two critically acclaimed productions. One was the premiere of Heartbreak Express, this fabulous opera about Dolly Parton's fans. And the other was Purcell's The Fairy Queen. So, on top of this, you've written a number of articles for Classical Singer. You have a doctorate from Indiana University, a master's from Peabody Conservatory, and an undergraduate degree from Illinois Wesleyan University. So my first question is, do you sleep?
Yes, I do. I have a very beautiful couch that I sleep on. But I do sleep, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I feel really good about myself right now. But all they're all true. And it's funny, I'm always joking with students and friends who are down on themselves about getting your resume out and just start updating it, because very quickly you think, oh my God, I've done all this stuff. Why am I freaking out, right? So at any rate, thank you. Thank you for having me. I am totally flattered and honored to get to be in this series and to get to be the first. And ask away.
Okay.
And if I am a spy, I think I'll fail at spy school if I say so, if that's the case.
Okay, your secret is safe with us. We're not going to give anything away. I think we've got an unstable internet connection.
We good?
We'll do our best. We'll do our best. So Peter, the first question I want to ask you is, maybe if you think back to when you were at Indiana University, and that's actually where we met, when you were working on Project Jumpstart. So that's also part of your background. But I'm just wondering, when you were in school, did you imagine you would have this kind of career?
No, not at all. And one of the very sweet full circle moments of getting to talk about what you do in life is that people ask you questions about things like what we're doing right now. And this morning I was doing an interview with a doctoral student at Indiana today for his dissertation, because it's about countertenors and gender identity and all this fun stuff. And I couldn't help but talk about my time at Indiana as well, of course. And I said to him, I didn't even really know why I went to get that doctorate. It was more for personal reasons that I went, and it felt like, I guess this is the thing to do. And if I get into this highly competitive program, that must be a sign. Well, I got in, but I think life would be really difficult to discern from then on out if I was looking for signs. And so that whole time, it wasn't until about a year and a half into that program that I sort of I didn't hit my stride, but I felt at home. I felt that that was, that I was engaged daily in things that I was learning and enjoying. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the very end of that degree, because I kept thinking, oh, well, I'll go do this. I'll get this pedigree so that I can get a higher paying administrative job. Because that had always been my day job before. Before Indiana, I was working for legendary arts presenter Ruth Felt as her executive assistant. And so I couldn't help, and I was gigging in San Francisco when I was working with her. I was doing great singing stuff. It was lovely, but I couldn't help but think, well, the money's actually coming from the day job. And I'm feeling pretty good that I have a kind of famous boss. And she became a mentor, whether or not I had realized it, she had. And I thought, that's what I'm supposed to do. So I guess I'll go get the word doctor to put before or after my name. And then I'll be a presenter, or I'll be a dean at a school. And like so many things in life, a big part of my personal life was wrapped up with going to school, but that's another interview for a different show. But I went, and it wasn't until the need for money really became strong in my heart while I was at Indiana, and my coach and dear friend, Kim Carballo, I feel like the school wouldn't run without her. She said that she was playing for a clarinetist, a doctoral student, who was an adult with a high school age child who wanted voice lessons. And would I be interested? And I thought, well, sure. And that was the first time I had to think, what do I charge? What do I charge in the different from what I charged in the couple of lessons I taught in San Francisco? And then I realized this was a very different part of my life that I wasn't engaging in, even though I was in a degree that was totally geared toward doing just that, learning how to teach, learning how to sing better so I could teach better and more effectively. But it wasn't until I started getting referrals, and for some reason, the law school at Indiana University got my name and number, and those professors made more money so they could pay for more lessons for their kids. So I became this weirdo who taught law school's children, professors, and a couple of lawyers on the faculty. Huh. And that's when I started to realize that I had a real desire to keep going with this teaching that was both for avocational students, law professors who didn't really want to perform, and then high schoolers who wanted preparation for show choir auditions or entry into Indiana.
Okay, so wait a minute.
And
so I got to ask you, did you have pedagogy classes up until this point? I mean, what sort of training did you have for teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. This is, I've had the standard pedagogy classes that you get as an undergraduate voice major, you know, one semester, which is full of great information, but I feel like I was a total idiot when I was, you know, in that stage of my life. I'm sure I memorized muscles and body parts and was like, what? I don't really need this. I'm going to be a famous singer. And then the same thing again in my master's. It seemed this really critical class again the second time through. I thought, oh, this is just a box to check off on the way to the career as a singer. And so it wasn't until Indiana, when it was especially when I sat down with my advisor, who ultimately was on my doctoral committee, when he was sort of saying, okay, this is what your life looks like for the next 4 years. And I thought, oh, what am I getting myself into, all these classes? And I saw way later on I would be taking these pedagogy classes. They were just marvelous. There were two. There was one that was this fabulous literature review. Another one was, again, sort of like a very amped up version of what I'd taken before, mm-hmm. where it was a smaller literature review with the authors that truly had shaped for the last 200, 250 years, what we consider to be modern and very usable, empowering vocal pedagogy.
And so I'm just wondering, at what point did you start to feel confident in your abilities as a teacher?
Well, very happily, when I got that call about, hey, why don't you teach this student? It was happening right around the same time that I had these classes and I could put this into practical application. And still though, I felt like there was a disconnect. And there was an optional course at Indiana, a teaching practicum, which you had to like get your friends to sign up so that the class could make. Otherwise, no one would teach it. And it was like one of the most valuable things I've ever done. You were given two non-major vocalists who were registered, and you had some writing assignments, but the thrust of the semester was teaching these students privately and then in the presence of Indiana's celebrated faculty. And it was awesome. It was, and they were, you know, each teacher's different, but they would give me pointers and they would affirm me in it. And then the student would leave and then they'd say, that was really good. Or, okay, I totally see what you're trying to do there. Tell them to round their corners and put their tongue down. And then you won't have to work. So that said, I started.
Wait, and how many different faculty were observing your teaching?
In that time, I think it was three separate faculty. And for me, a real boon was that my teacher wasn't one of them, because she is one of the best pedagogues there is. And I got to say to her in my lessons, and now I'm sure she heard, or when she hears this, she'll kind of laugh, like, yeah, duh, that's what I was trying to get you to do. She wanted me to talk about this. And so I'd say, well, Professor so-and-so said this, and I don't quite get this. And she'd say, let me translate, blah, blah, blah. And that's so I got an extra teacher in that. Now, all of that said, I finished the degree with a really busy private studio, socked away a ton of money, I mean, relatively, and then spent all of it on my apartment in New York to get it and to pay the broker. Started immediately in two day jobs that were great day jobs, but for other people. For me, they became administrative prisons. And so, but I just needed to get money and to work. So it wasn't until after the first 7 months in New York when I left a job at Indiana and health insurance and 401k and all these things were told to hold dear. I went to New York, got these two day jobs, managing an opera singer, running a festival at Lincoln Center, realizing this, I'm not singing, I'm not teaching. And I was able to get released from those positions. And then I started volunteer career advising at NYU. They didn't need to know I had no job. And so I started doing career advising for business and hard science majors at NYU, CVs and resumes, and just to feel useful and to keep my chops up with things that I had learned from the best, from you, as you were mentoring me through Project Jumpstart and how to effectively run that second year. And so as soon as that was done, I found myself not getting any kind of work for the jobs I thought I was supposed to. After all that high-end New York administrative experience, no one would hire me. And I wrote this article that happily died on my phone called What the F by a Doctor, because just this whole diatribe, I should be doing this, this, and that. I'm glad that no one will ever see that. That was just me fetching. But I just kept trying to make opportunities. Like I started writing for Classical Singer. I identified some people that I thought that the readership would want to hear from. And in a really sweet twist, I ended up serving as a coach for Manhattan Girls Chorus. Because when I was working for that opera singer, one of the last things I did was to obtain a quote from the singer about the chorus with whom he recently. And on that last week, I thought, well, I'm going to just go for it. And I said to the chorus director who owns the company too, I said, I'm also a voice teacher specializing in the age of a student that you work with. I'd love to come in and give a free workshop. And I did. And it didn't turn into anything quickly. But 5 months later, I got a phone call on Halloween. And I promised, took a long way around the airport. I promise this is all in service of the question of when did you start feeling good as a teacher? But ultimately, I started working with that chorus, and at a time where I was so wildly unemployed, and talk about running a sack full of coins to the bank. Within 3 weeks, I was sitting on stage at Carnegie Hall cueing this chorus because I'd taken a chance, started working with them. She hired me. And then it turned out that through some sweet communications that I do not believe were misleading, I became known as the leading Bavarian diction specialist.
Hey, wait a minute. I didn't find that on your bio.
My friend Michelle, who wrote the chorus, I was talking to her and she said, I just want to give you a heads up. The American Symphony Orchestra is about to call you up to offer you diction coaching for the grown-ups. And I said, but these are going to be jaded adult singers. They're going to know I'm not the leading Bavarian diction specialist. And she said a piece of advice that I think I say every single day at some point, and sometimes many times with students and sometimes to myself. Michelle said, you need to proceed as though you know exactly what you're doing. I went back to what I learned in my doctorate, which that's where I really learned to write while I was also learning to teach. And I thought, I feel in control when I take a big body of whatever, and I'm so OCD, I like things in threes, and I put it into three. So when that orchestra called, I said, listen, I'd love to work with the chorus, but Bavarian dialect is so complicated. There are so many villages. So we cannot have 50 shades of Bavarian. We have to stick to these three rules. I didn't make them up, but they're certainly, they were Peter specific. to pay a dude in Missouri who I had found, I ended up dating this guy, but I found out that it was his hobby, Bavarian dialect. What? So all of that.
Wow.
Before that happened and things started to actually happen on a level where people knew that I was teaching, I started teaching avocational singers in New York. I had a priest, a library, and a librarian who I'd gotten from a chorus that I was volunteer conducting at a synagogue on the Upper West Side. And I put them all on Fridays back to back because I'm a big dork and I wanted to tell people, I have a priest, a rabbi, and a librarian today. And so that said, it was so rewarding because I was teaching again, and it had felt like those months since I'd left Indiana, it had felt like eons, but it felt good. It felt like I was at the right desk, the right keyboard at my piano at home teaching. And that's when I started feeling very comfortable in my teaching because I wasn't being graded. I wasn't being a practicum. And these were appreciative students, and a turn of events that happened because I just reached out to an old friend to go out for dinner without knowing he would do this. He recommended me to be a voice teacher for a very profitable, very effective corporate firm that prepares high school juniors and seniors for musical theater college auditions. And I was told when I was hired, it was a wonderful TV movie moment. I demo taught, and then it was congratulations, welcome, I got the job. And they sent me in for some financial training for just to see how the company works. And I said to the person doing that, I said, how many students can I expect to have? And he said, well, we'll start you off slowly with maybe four for the semester. And when you're good at what you do and when you're trained and when you take chances and you quite clearly are enjoying it, I think good things really do happen. Mm-hmm. In that time, I'm supposed to have had four students. I had 40 by the end of the year.
Wow. So wait a minute, Peter, catch us up on this. How long ago was the priest, the rabbi, and the librarian? Like how short a span has this been?
So the priest, the rabbi, and the librarian, that was in the winter of 2000. And then that Carnegie Hall thing was also that winter and the beginning of 2014. And then I had a dinner with that friend in March of that same year. Wow. And then April, I had landed that gig. So in perspective, when I left the opera singer gig, and I started the Lincoln Center one because I fulfilled that contract. But when I left the big gig that had my health insurance and had my salary, That was April of 2013.
Wow.
And a year later, by that time, I had ended a 10-year personal relationship. I had left all these jobs. I had been freelancing a bit, but a year later, it seemed like an eternity. But now I look at it and I go, how did that happen so fast? I'd been published. I'd been on stage at Carnegie Hall. And then I got this job with the firm. And so working with these 40 plus high schoolers, who, of course, I suffered from imposter syndrome a little bit as that started, because I thought, I haven't really been teaching regularly for a good long time. They're going to know if I don't know X, Y, and Z. What? No, I have plenty of knowledge. And so in doing that, I had a beautiful laboratory of kids who were the age of the kids that I'd worked with in Bloomington. They just happened to live in a different place. Yeah. And they also be in a region of a different type of affluence that I'd not experienced before, which meant that some of these kids could afford two or three lessons a week. And a couple of times I thought, is this bad? Is this too much? Is this smarmy? Who needs three lessons in a week? But sometimes it's very effective. And I think about the apprenticeship model of music making a long, long time ago. And that also can be quite effective.
Yeah.
So it was in that year in 2014, and then going a whole cycle with these kids, that after that happened, I thought, this is great. Not only am I master of my schedule for the most part, but also word's getting out through referrals from these people for private students too. And so I went from having the rabbi, priest, and librarian, who are all dear friends still and come for lessons, but then it became totally unexpected. The person who owns that corporate firm, she also is a voice pathologist at Cornell, while Cornell in the city. And she started giving me these secret referrals for Broadway singers who were her clients, people who had gotten into a little bit of vocal trouble. And oddly, you know, in athletics, there are press conferences when somebody tears an ACL and there's a plan of attack and it is public. But in singing, it's, oh dear, shh, don't, no, you'll never work again. And so, and that really has not, there's been so much advancement and a raising of awareness with regard to rehabilitation for the voice, because the voice is so resilient, and yet it is still shrouded in taboo, absolutely at the operatic level, but not as much at the Broadway level. But these are people who are working for these great contracts that they don't want anyone to ever know that there's any kind of problem. So I started getting these singers from like Book of Mormon and Wicked and blah, 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 who were saying, who were going through therapy. And then my boss at that firm was saying, now you've gone through therapy, now let's get you singing correctly again. You haven't been to a voice teacher in a while, have you? I have this doctor of music who understands anatomy in a way that a lot of the other voice teachers in this city don't.
Peter, where did you get the confidence to deal with people at that level in terms of, you know, vocal health?
That's a great question. The vocal health thing, because talk about imposter syndrome. I just came from the Nats National Conference, and it was wonderful. But one of the things I continued to notice was there is this constant urgency for some people in these either breakout sessions or panels, not on the panel, but in the audience, to start talking as much anatomy as possible. There's a power there. It sort of shrouds fears. And I was thinking like, oh God, what if I have forgotten where my cricoarytenoids are, or is the thyroid cartilage the one that covers up the vocal cords, or is it, you know, all of this? And when I started working with these students, I did one very sentimental thing. I thought about my voice teacher from high school who had said, honey, when you sing, you need egotism. And I just thought, well, that just sounds great. I never knew what the hell that meant, but I use that word also now every day when I say to students, of course, this has to be for other people, ticket buyers, people who are going to cast you to book you in a gig. But if you're going to engage in the terrifying act of public singing, when most people's biggest fear is public speaking, you got to think you're pretty good at this. And it has to be for you. Other Otherwise, who cares? What are we doing here? To quote Jerry Seinfeld, right? And so,
wait a minute. I wanna back up to the two quotes we've got so far. So what's the first one? Remind me of the first one.
Oh, honey, you need egotism.
Right, and the one before that was believing in yourself.
You need to proceed as though you know exactly what you're doing. And both of those I have riffed on endlessly, you know, depending on the student and the situation.
I'm interested in the negative self-talk that gets so many musicians in that place of the imposter syndrome. And I'm guessing that this isn't just happening at times for you as a teacher, or has happened in the past, but also as a performer. Is it different, the ways that shows up?
Yeah, I think with that, and as teachers, we all have these things where we're like, oh my God, I used this line 2 lessons ago, but it's a new rule. So it's myself saying a lot when it comes to this confidence. Well, if I have somebody singing persistently flat and I say to them, oh yeah, but just go out there and just let it go and sing flat for all those people. Yeah, I'd be a horrible teacher, and that you'd be panned, and then students laugh, and then they feel a little, they're disarmed from their fear, and they're like, oh yeah, okay. And so all of that is to say, for them, I say, and this speaks to imposter syndrome ultimately, I say, it does me no service, I make no more or less money, and it does you no service if I affirm out of insincerity. And a colleague of mine says that in a slightly more crass way when she says, I don't bullshit nurture. And when I have a student who doesn't, if that line that I just said doesn't quite work, then I'll say that.
Yeah.
But I say that to myself too, because to answer your question from earlier about how did I get confident to be able to talk about anatomy and what does one do when they're on the road in a national tour of a Tony winning show, first national tour, and they have a vocal paresis, a paralysis on one chord, where that was really never covered in any of my education because that wasn't exactly the path that I took. I go back to, of course, that, yeah, proceed like you know what you're doing because you do. And if you're concerned, you got a shelf full of books and an iPhone full of contacts, full of people who you can reach out to, mm-hmm. which is a comfort to them when I honor the moment and say, let's address that later. They don't need to know that I'm going to make a call later on. I always know where I can go. And then the other thing is this, and this sounds overly simple, but great, because when you sing and you cannot see the involuntary, wildly complicated, coordinated muscular efforts in your body that you're affecting sometimes through imagery, sometimes through very direct application of anatomical technique, whatever's simple, grab onto it. What's simple is repeatable and more repeatable. And so for me, I think, well, if they're sounding like that, let me do an impression, an overinflated impression, privately, not in front of them, of what's going on. And chances are, I think, oh God, well, my soft palate is so not raised at all. It's almost touching my tongue. That's part of it too. So a lot of the time, it's just a matter of very common physical things that really aren't the result of an injury that they sustain. Sometimes people sustain an injury because they sneezed during an ear infection or laryngitis. But most of the time, these people get sidelined for a bit, and it's a wake-up call for they like, oh wow, I was able to make this work for up until now with this philosophy of let's see how it happens tonight. Not sure what's going to come out tonight. And then I feel like that is what makes somebody a 20-year singer when they would have been a 10 or a 4-year singer when they say, God, I had that problem. Because now that forced me to go and actually look at the key components of singing. And so as a teacher, I find myself repeating so many, as we all do, so many of the same things a lot, to the point that I have my voice teacher at Indiana, I'll call her up I'll text her late at night, even though I like hate it if a student texts me late at night. So I don't do this too much, but I'll text her and I'll say, Mrs. H, can I use my lifeline? And she'll call me right up. And one of these times that, and it's usually actually, it's usually an emotional thing when I call up, if I feel like I'm giving too much or there's not enough left for me or whatever. And one of the things I said to her one night was, I'm feeling a bit like a fraud. I said, I've never felt so professionally satisfied and gratified, but I feel like I'm saying the same three things over and over. I'm not jumping around as much as I used to from concept to concept. Is that allowed or am I getting lazy? And she said, no, it's just that so much of this stuff, you're just getting more efficient. And you're able, in my words, I like to say, I'm much more able to just do what I've always wanted to do, which is show up and be the talent and then go and do research when you need to. And don't be ashamed to say to somebody, you know, I'm not sure no one's ever asked that. Let's look it up together or I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah.
So that now, 2017, this has happened really quickly. And in that time, very happily, and not that I'm bored with my work by any stretch, but working with high school seniors has its joys, but it also has its limitations, both technically and emotionally. I'm a big softy, and having students for 8 months to a year kind of breaks my heart sometimes. And then, as you know, I have a lot of these Broadway people, but I also got so many jaded recent college graduates. And that was a different challenge. That's when the concept of music entrepreneurship, I've had to go into hyperdrive with them, especially these kids paying these, or their parents paying these exorbitant Manhattan rents. Mm-hmm. And in between, I've been so fortunate that, and I say that, yes, I'm fortunate. I'm exhausted. I've worked my ass off for the last 5 years and I'm grateful for all that. But I'm one of these people who got a college gig in the way that you want it to happen. And it's not a full-time tenure track position, but I've always said in this setup, that's not what I've wanted for now. But yeah. I had somebody call me up and say, we're looking for a voice teacher at Pace and you've come highly recommended by two people. Are you interested in continuing this conversation? And, you know, I went, oh, yeah. And that led to one of the best interviews I've ever given, because it happened, A, at the wrong time. I hadn't taken a shower yet, so I had hair sticking all over the place. And
So that's the piece of advice you would give people with finishing their doctorate? Don't shower.
There's not a whole lot of sophisticated going on, not in here, but up here. But, a cowlick will land you a college job. But the other thing was this, when people say stuff like, oh, go in there and interview like you don't need the job. Well, yeah, there's really something to that. I didn't know how emotionally and how artistically I needed the job at the time. Teaching at the university level has absolutely satisfied and gratified something in me that I didn't quite know that I was missing when I was teaching kids on both sides of it. Mm-hmm. Now I feel so happy because it's this integrated thing. Seeing I can talk to them on all different levels of this. And even with the young kids with Broadway Kids auditions, which was another corporate firm gig that I picked up in a conversation with a friend. And it keeps coming down to these conversations with friends that you have to leave your house in order to have, usually. Which but the college gig thing was... the interview for that, it wasn't that I didn't want to teach at that school. I've been working so hard to get so many of my high school seniors into there. So I thought, well, great. I'll loop with them. They'll get in and maybe they're tired of me, but watch out. I'm going to be your freshman year voice teacher. but again, it was, I'm just going to have a conversation. And instead, I was kind of flashing back to an earlier version of me at job interviews with and I, the same way if I audition for stuff, you know, very buttoned up and okay, come on, let's do this. You've practiced an hour today, you know, this high stakes, hour long practicing and all this. I just said to the, to Amy Rogers, who hired me, she's the wonderful chair and designer of this program. She just had a baby. And so I knew that her time was very limited. It was the summer. I was in between Skype lessons with terrible hair. However, that worked out. I was in a t-shirt. I was supposed to do it 2 hours later. I had an audition or an interview shirt laid up. Didn't do it that way. And we talked and I just said, I know you're really busy. So I'm just going to tell you a whole bunch about me, my teaching philosophy, what I do, and what I think is going to be useful in our time together. Are you cool with that? I've never been more direct in my life, especially in a job interview situation. And she said, yes, great, go. And so I just did. And we ended up having such a great conversation that was need and student based. And in a way where I could absolutely be self-promotional as you're supposed to be and do, but in far less of a formal way. Yeah. And so I know that, that's just me and that's just one instance of this, but flash forward just 3 years before, or actually at that point, 2 years before, the day that I found out I had an interview for that corporate firm, I was also going into an interview, the final round, to be the executive director of a community music school on the Upper West Side. It would have been more money than I had ever made. I would have had an office in the basement with a faculty of 40 very disenchanted, disenfranchised, angry teachers, with a board that was wanting to place an unrealistic capital campaign on whoever they hired. It would have been awful. And so, and I kept thinking, I kept getting called back into this. And this last interview was with the board, and I ultimately didn't get it, and great. But I remember being outside in my suit on the Upper West Side and kind of looking at the river and just sort of thinking about, like, well, maybe this is another one I won't get. Maybe I will get it, but I didn't want it. And then I got this email saying, you've come highly recommended from your friend Will Reynolds. Would you come in and do some demo teaching? That's all I needed to let my posture go from, to, oh my God, there are options. Look at this thing that you went into student debt for and that you've trained for. And so I went into that that interview, and immediately, same deal, it turned into a, let's talk about needs, let's talk about blah, blah, blah. And one of the hardest things, I think, when I'm talking to my students is that, and I tell them right away, I tell them about my work in music entrepreneurship and my lineage in that. And I tell them about you. I tell them about our work together at Indiana and this field that so many of them haven't heard about. You know, when I define entrepreneurship and talk to my college seniors about money and what life is and opportunities, I can't not let my teaching be colored by all of that.
Yeah.
And yet all of this is to say, I could never have planned any of this. If I had said, and I went to Indiana and gave a career talk about this a couple of years ago, and I said, when I said no to the option on my contract, my faculty contract for Jumpstart, if somebody had said, well, what are you going to do in New York? And I said, you know, I don't know. But my partner, we're both going to leave here, not have jobs, sell our condo, rent a truck, put our cats in it, drive to New York, get an apartment with no jobs. And then because I am entrepreneur enough, was able to get two jobs, but they were the wrong ones for me. My soul felt crushed. My artistry felt crushed. I'll do that for 7 months, get out of it, have no money, no insurance, and then interview for a whole bunch of jobs that I should have gotten, not get them. And then just to make matters easier, I'm gonna get rid of the last source of stability, my partner of 10 years, and then start everything anew. And then just happen to go out for dinner with an old friend because I was lonesome, talk his ear off about teaching, and then not know that he's going to put me forward for a job that would ultimately change my life monetarily and artistically. If that was my plan, I would sound absolutely bonkers. Yeah. And half of the room at this talk of mostly doctoral students at Indiana, half of the room went like this. Like this. And I said, But this is not for everybody.
Yeah.
And so it happened to be for me, and that's great. But I think the better way that people talk about this now is this term of pivoting, career pivoting, instead of this or that, and rolling with this or that, and then seeing what this takes you to. And all the while through this, what I continue to find so wildly valuable is that in these times, and I say when I wasn't employed, I sure as hell was employed, because I was writing market research reports on lettuce and mayonnaise distribution throughout North America, because my brother hooked me up with this weird data entry and writing gig. That paid a debt. And then I started ghost writing for classical artists, a few of them, for their social media, and designing websites. All of these things I had either learned from my ability to learn to write at Indiana, or when I was working for the opera singer in high international finance and major big league conversations with presenters and opera houses. All this stuff that I found to be so tedious at times have become the most wonderful friends to me, because I can do it for my own business. Learning a member or buying a subscription to QuickBooks online and doing your own accounting is so much more gratifying than when you're doing somebody else's accounting. So all these special skills, especially for my musical theater kids, we're always talking about the special skills at the bottom of the resume.
Yeah.
And I think the special skills about, do you know what Microsoft Excel is? Do you, you know, it can't be oversold, rather.
Yeah. So Peter, just to wrap this up, what I'm curious about is, what do you see for the future? Like, is there a special project that you're working on? Are you going to be doing more of the State Department travel teaching, or what?
Yeah. The State Department teaching is, the nonprofit in the States is called American Voices. They work with cooperation with the State Department and then various embassies of countries that are either still in the throes of isolation, like a dictatorship, or coming out of isolation. And I got that gig because I happened to get a call from a friend who couldn't do something and they needed help. I mean, like so many people get their gigs. You're ready and you're talented and you show up the first, second, and third days and you're a good person and you're good at what you do, blah, blah, blah. That, all that said, that's turned into this part of my career that I never would have thought that I would start going to places like Turkmenistan and Jakarta to lead a Broadway academy or to teach Italian prosody for Turkmen and Russian speaking people. And the first one of these I went on, I encountered a faculty that was very doubtful of me, a bunch of post-Soviet teachers who thought that, because I look younger than I am, who thought that, what does this young kid know about how to teach? But what I found out, like I find out every time, and I learned this from you, was at the beginning of workshops that we planned together, you showed me the amazing power of polling, gauging the room. What are some concerns? And getting someone from the crowd to come up and be the person who writes down what is being said, and you get two or three of these concerns, and then you just sort of breathe some relief to know you don't have to cover everything in an hour and a half. If you can get to three, if you can get to one or two of these in a detailed way, amazing. And so in Turkmenistan, I found that they needed Italian diction work. I was there, I was hired to teach Christmas songs for a holiday concert that would happen months later. I ended up giving Italian opera master classes. I'd never been asked to flex that muscle professionally. And realized, oh yeah, duh, you're a Handelian countertenor. Of course you have some things to say here. So those international jobs, and the next one was far more Broadway based. They needed me to be a music director. And the imposter syndrome kicked in, and I thought, well, I can't really play the piano. I only have played the piano since I was 5 years old and play it 7 hours a day with my students. Of course I can play the piano. Get play for your students. And then the same thing with the conducting. And so these teaching missions, they're known as cultural diplomacy missions, have also been one of the greatest things for my career, because now I have international conducting credits. I've been on these international live streams. I have had these interactions with State Department, embassies, and also students from over 10 ASEAN countries, students in challenging situations. And all of these things, to put a big old wrap up on this part of it, all of these things serve absolutely, they're very much in the service of what I like to do when I work with someone on a cover letter. I say, look, take a piece of paper and just go to the first line of each paragraph. If you were to bold that, would that be what you wanted? Or would it just be a whole bunch of crap before you got up the gumption and the courage to say what you're proud of? And all of these things, like when I work for the opera singer, when you look at any of these bios that say so-and-so has sung with all the major conductors and all the important houses and blah, 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 that's what a lot of people are going for. And so I look at these experiences, and when I won this independent teaching award last year, which I self-nominated myself for, and I think I earned it, but I put myself up for it, and I'm not ashamed of that. That all of a sudden gave me, you know, that was 2 hours I spent writing that application one February morning. Well, I had other things I could have done, but because I did that, and because I had the ability to win that, now I get that thing that everyone wants to say, so-and-so is an award-winning teacher. Well, the fear of getting yelled at by these hulking, scary Russian teachers, well, I held my own. Now, the next paragraph can start with, Peter Thorsen is internationally in demand as a music director and clinician. You know, these things that so many of the people that I worked with, and I was one of these people too, during my doctoral times, when I was like, how do I make these two or three experiences sound better on my they're there. And I don't know, I've been able to check off the performance aspects of those boxes as well. And I'll conclude with this. When I look at my resume, and when people ask me to look at their resumes and they don't put years on, I'm always like, come on, they're looking for that reverse chronological order. They're wanting to know, is the last thing you did in 2011? And for me, I had realized that the last thing I had done operatically said 2010 or 11. This was in 2014. And I took an audition for a freebie gig, The Fairy Queen, that got BroadwayWorld.com said Peter Thorsen singing Spellbinding. I wound up on the front of New York Times, blah, 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 all this stuff. I'm not saying to sing for free, but in that moment of my life, it was the right decision.
Yeah.
And so all of these things that I've done in service to my students and to the profession of teaching have consistently provided performance opportunities that I never would have sought out, and that also I auditioned for better because I thought, actually, I'm making really good money as a teacher. I don't really need this gig to make rent. Well, that makes me a much less nervous auditioner than I was in the past. And again, that's just my route story on it.
Wow, this is great.
That's it for now, but I do look forward to more international teaching. And this summer, it's going to be the Broadway Academy again, and we're not sure yet if it's either going to be Jakarta again or Bangkok. Most likely followed by Lebanon immediately after to do one of these academies, but opera-focused, and then back to Turkmenistan in the fall. So
fabulous.
Having me.
Yeah. So New York agrees with you. You think you're going to be staying there for the...
I do. The city, it's not that I feel guilty, but I think I was raised in a household where feeling guilty religiously was like, you know, part of what we do. And so when I see a lot of my colleagues from different degrees, undergrad, grad and grad school, second time around, when I see some people on the train who are super bummed out, and they're saying, I'm giving New York another 5 months and that's it. Oh, that's great. That's fine. This isn't Rome. This isn't the be all end all of whatever, but it kind of is when it comes to your ability to get on a subway on the Upper West Side, where everyone's coming back and forth from all of these places. You just run into people, and the more people you run into, the more opportunities you might be able to have. That said, I find that a lot of the people that are so discouraged frequently are the people who, and this is great that it happened for them at the time, but they're the people who got all the leads and maybe had a studio teacher that served as their manager at the school and created more on their behalf. And that's great that that happened for them. But what isn't great is that that skill of needing to be a scrappy, self-managing artist, which so many, lots of famous artist friends that I have, they talk about, already established famous people, talking about the self-management things a lot better, whether or not it's a decision because you don't like a manager or you can't get a manager. The skill of self-managing is so critical. And I feel a little badly talking about this, because for me, some of the best relationships in my life, mentoring relationships, have been, of course, my primary teachers who have been there to help me with things. But one of the streams behind all of that, and I don't know if I happened to gravitate toward these people because I needed this and wasn't aware of it, those were loving, caring people, but they never did things for me that I could have otherwise done on my own.
Yeah.
And that isn't to say that I didn't have a teacher at Peabody who knew that I didn't have any money one weekend, and for whatever reason, he slipped me $40. Because I was so poor, like that, he did that for me. That's a sweet, sweet thing. And I love talking to students about paying things forward. But the more important thing to pay forward is something that I learned so much from you, which was the tools, the toolkit of how to do this. I probably, in our relationship as friend and mentor and mentee and everything we've done together, you sent me like 5,000 documents with track changes about things, but it's never been, I finished it, I did it, just send it in. And it's always been, well, you might consider this. This might not be landing. This might land better. And there are people who absolutely just want to throw money at something, and that's it. And sometimes that's effective, but it's only effective that April, not every April after that.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point. Well, thank you so much, Peter.
Edgy at the interview, so. But thank you for having me. Good luck with the book, and I can't wait to read the next edition.
Oh, well, thanks a million, Peter. We'll talk again soon.
Sounds good.
Okay. Oh, wait. How can people find you online?
Oh, sure. My name, peterthorason.com. And for New Yorkers who might want to have a lesson or a session that's also aimed at entrepreneurship and getting your career and your voice going at the same time, can book a session at singwithpeter.com. And then occasionally I tweet. I feel like tweet is a dirty word these days, but I tweet from Dr. Pete's tweets.
Okay, fabulous. Thank you so much, Peter. Talk to you again soon.
Bye, Angela.
Bye.